Sometimes, Lewis, dead is better.
This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. And today, we're finally getting to the story that I promised years ago. Today's episode is going to be me reading Squad D by Stephen King. This is not the first Stephen King story I've run on my podcast. In fact, I think this is probably the fourth. First one that I did was my favorite Stephen King short story, One for the Road. And I read that essentially for Marshall Latham, who hadn't read Stephen King, just because I love that story so much. And I think it wasn't the first story I had recorded, the one that I had recorded first for the show, because I did Stephen King stories years and years ago before I was ever a podcaster, you know, when I was a teenager. But first one I did was The Crate, because it's never been collected, and I was fairly sure there was no audio available, no audio book. One for the Road, there is a professional audiobook available, so it doesn't make me special. Third one I did was The Reploids, and it was another story that's never been collected by King. And when I say never been collected, I mean it's not appeared in any of his collections. Most of these stories, with the exception of today's story, have been in magazines or have been in anthologies. And One for the Road was in Night Shift. But Reploids has never been collected in a King anthology. And it still just boggles my mind how incomplete that story feels to me. I still stand by my assertion that it is part of a novel that was never completed. The fourth one that I did was The Revelations of Becca Paulson. And I did that one because I had released my readings of The Crate and The Reploids on YouTube. And there were some strangers who had commented. And one of them said, oh, what are you going to do next? Please do The Revelations of Becca Paulson. And so I did. And I didn't like that story at all. But why not? I put it out there, and now my reading is out there. And that brings us to this last story. When I first started, I thought it would be cool to do a reading of Squad D, because not only has it never been in any of Stephen King's collections, but it's not ever been in any collections. This was a story that King wrote in the 70s for inclusion in Harlan Ellison's third Dangerous Visions anthology. And we can talk about it afterward, but that third anthology never came out. It's been 40 years, and it never came out. But people got their hands on that story over the years, and in 2019, it's finally coming out. Now that Ellis is dead, King is putting it in, or Cemetery Dance, rather, is putting it in an anthology, one of their Shivers anthologies. So I don't know that I'll be buying that Shivers anthology, but I would be really curious to read the Squad D that appears there, because this one is a typed up transcript of somebody's scan of the original manuscript from one of the hands that it went in, fell into, and it was riddled with typos and a couple of moments where I just had to interpret the text because what I was reading was nonsense. And so, without any further ado, I hope you enjoy Squad D by Unca Steve. Thanks.
Squad D by Stephen King. Billy Clouson died all at once, with 9 of the 10 other members of D-Squad, on April 8, 1974. It took his mother 2 years, but she got started right away, on the afternoon the telegram announcing her son's death came, in fact. Dale Clouson simply sat in the front hall for 5 minutes, the sheet of yellow, flimsy paper dangling from his fingers, not sure if he was going to faint, or puke, or scream, or what. When he was able to get up, he went into the living room. He was in time to observe Andrea down the last swallow of the first drink and pour the post-Billy era's second drink. A good many more drinks followed. It was really amazing how many drinks that small and seemingly frail woman had been able to pack into a 2-year period. The written cause, that which appeared on her death certificate, was liver dysfunction and renal failure. Both Dale and the family doctor knew that was formalistic icing on an extremely alcoholic cake. Baba O'Rum, perhaps. But only Dale knew there was a third level. The Viet Congs had killed their son in a place called Kai Do, and Billy's death had killed his mother. It was 3 years. 3 years almost to the day, after Billy's death on the bridge, that Dale Clouson began to believe that he must be going mad.
9, he thought. There were 9. There were always 9. Until now. Were there?
His mind replied to itself.
Are you sure? Had you really counted? The lieutenant's letter said there were 9, and Bortman's letter said there were 9, so just how can you be so sure? Maybe you just assumed.
But he hadn't just assumed, and he could be sure because he knew how many 9 was, and there had been 9 boys in the D-Squad photograph which had come in the mail, along with Lieutenant Anderson's letter.
You could be wrong,
his mind insisted, with an assurance that was slightly hysterical. You've been through a lot these last couple of years. What with losing first Billy and then Andrea, you could be wrong. It was really surprising, he thought, to what insane lengths the human mind would go to protect its own sanity. He put his finger down on the new figure, a boy of Billy's age, but with blonde, crew-cut hair, looking no more than 16, surely too young to be on the killing ground. He was sitting, cross-legged, in front of Gibson, who had, according to Billy's letters, played the guitar, and Kimberly, who told lots of dirty jokes. The boy with the blonde hair was squinting slightly into the sun. So were several of the others, but they had always been there before. The new boy's fatigue shirt was open, his dog tags lying against his hairless chest. Dale went into the kitchen, sorted through what he and Andrea had always called the jumble drawers, and came up with an old, scratched magnifying glass. He took it and the picture over to the living room window, tilted the picture so there was no glare, and held the glass over the new boy's dog tags. He couldn't read them. Thought, in fact, that the tags were both turned over and lying face down against the skin. And yet, a suspicion had dawned in his mind. It ticked there like the clock on the mantel. He had been about to wind that clock when he had noticed the change in the picture. Now he put the picture back in its accustomed place, between a photograph of Andrea and Billy's graduation picture, found the key to the lock, and wound it. Lieutenant Anderson's letter had been simple enough. Now Dale found it in his study desk and read it again. Typed lines on army stationery, the prescribed follow-up to the telegram, Dale had supposed. First, telegram. Second, letter of condolence from lieutenant. Third, coffin, 1 boy enclosed. He had noticed then, and noticed again now, that the typewriter Anderson used had a flying O. Clouson kept coming out Clues-un. Andrea had wanted to tear the letter up. Dale insisted that they keep it. Now he was glad. Billy's squad and two others had been involved in a flank sweep of a jungle quadrant, of which Kaido was the only village. Enemy contact had been anticipated, Anderson's letter said, but there hadn't been any. The Kong, which had been reliably reported to be in the area, had simply melted away into the jungle. It was a trick with which the American soldiers had become very familiar over the previous 10 years or so. Dale could imagine them heading back to their base at Homan, happy, relieved. Squads A and C had waded across the Kai River, which was almost dry. Squad D used the bridge. Halfway across, it blew up. Perhaps it had been detonated from downstream. More likely, someone, perhaps even Billy himself, had stepped on the wrong board. All 9 of them had been killed. Not a single survivor. God, if there really is such a being, is usually kinder than that, Dale thought. He put Lieutenant Anderson's letter back and took out Josh Bortman's letter. It had been written on blue-lined paper from what looked like a child's tablet. Bortman's handwriting was nearly illegible, the scrawl made worse by the writing implement, a soft lead pencil. Obviously blunt to start with, it must have been no more than a nub by the time Bortman signed his name at the bottom. In several places, Bortman had borne down hard enough with his instrument to tear the paper. It had been Bortman, the 10th man, who sent Dale and Andrea the squad picture, already framed, the glass over the photo miraculously unbroken in its long trip from Homan to Saigon to San Francisco, and finally to Binghamton, New York. Bortman's letter was anguished. He called the other 9, the best friends I ever had in my life. I loved them all like they was my brothers. Dale held the blue-lined paper in his hand and looked blankly through his study door and toward the sound of the ticking clock on the mantelpiece. When the letter came, in early May of 1974, he had been too full of his own anguish to really consider Bortman's. Now he supposed he could understand it. A little, anyway. Bortman had been feeling a deep and inarticulate guilt. 9 letters from his hospital bed on the Homan base, all in that pained scrawl, all probably written with that same soft lead pencil. The expense of having 9 enlargements of the Squad D photograph made and framed and mailed off. Rites of atonement with a soft lead pencil, Dale thought, folding the letter again and putting it back in the drawer with Anderson's. As if he had killed them by taking their picture. That's really what was between the lines, wasn't it? Please don't hate me, Mr. Clouson. Please don't think I killed your son and the others by... In the other room, the mantelpiece clock softly began to chime the hour of 5. Dale went back into the living room and took the picture down again. What you're talking about is madness. Looked at the boy with the short blonde hair again. I loved them all like they was my brothers. Turned the picture over. Please don't think I killed your son, all of your sons, by taking their picture. Please don't hate me because I was in the Homan base hospital with bleeding hemorrhoids instead of on the Kaido Bridge with the best friends I ever had in my life. Please don't hate me because I finally caught up. It took me 10 years of trying, but I finally caught up. Written on the back, in the same soft lead pencil, was this notation. Jack Bradley, Omaha, Neb. Billy Clouson, Binghamton, NY. Ryder Dotson, Oneonton, NY. Charlie Gibson, Payson, ND. Bobby Kale, Henderson, IA. Jack Kimberly, Truth or Consequences, NM. Andy Moulton, Faraday, LA, Staff Sergeant. Jimmy Oliphant, Beeson, Dell. Astley St. Thomas, Anderson, IND. Asterisk. Josh Bortman, Castle Rock, ME. He had put his own name last, Dale saw. He had seen all of this before, of course, and had noticed it, but had never really noticed it until now, perhaps. He had put his name last, out of alphabetical order, and with an asterisk. The asterisk means still alive. The asterisk means don't hate me.
Ah, but what you're thinking is madness, and you damned well know it.
Nevertheless, he went to the telephone, dialed O, and ascertained that the area code for Maine was 207. He dialed Maine Directory Assistance and ascertained that there was a single Bortman family in Castle Rock. He thanked the operator, wrote the number down, and looked at the telephone.
You don't really intend to call those people, do you?
No answer, only the sound of the ticking clock. He had put the picture on the sofa, and now he looked at it. Looked first at his own son, his hair pulled back behind his head, a brave little mustache trying to grow on his upper lip, frozen forever at the age of 21. And then at the new boy in that old picture, the boy with the short blonde hair, the boy whose dog tags were twisted so they lay face down and unreadable against his chest. He thought of the way Josh Bortman had carefully segregated himself from the others, thought of the asterisk, and suddenly his eyes filled with warm tears.
I never hated you, son, he thought. Nor did Andrea, for all her grief. Maybe I should have picked up a pen and dropped you a note saying so. But honest to Christ, the thought never crossed my mind.
He picked up the phone now and dialed the Bortman number in Castle Rock, Maine. Busy. He hung up and sat for 5 minutes, looking out at the street where Billy had learned to ride first a trike, then a bike with trainer wheels, and then a two-wheeler. At 18, he had brought home the final improvement, a Yamaha 500. For just a moment, he could see Billy with paralyzing clarity, as if he might walk through the door and sit down. He dialed the Bortman number again. This time it rang. The voice on the other end managed to convey an unmistakable impression of wariness in just 2 syllables.
Hello?
At that same moment, Dale's eyes fell on the dial of his wristwatch and read the date. Not for the first time that day, but it was the first time it really sunk in. It was April 9th. Billy and the others had died 11 years ago, yesterday. They...
Hello?
The voice repeated sharply.
Answer me or I'm hanging up. Which one are you?
Which one are you?
He stood in the ticking living room, cold, listening to words croak out of his mouth.
My name is Dale Clouson, Mr. Bortman. My son...
Clouson. Billy Clouson's father.
Now the voice was flat, inflectionless.
Yes, that's...
So you say.
Dale could find no reply. For the first time in his life, he really was tongue-tied.
And has your picture of Squad D changed, too?
Yes.
It came out in a strangled little gasp. Bortman's voice remained inflectionless, but it was nonetheless filled with savagery.
You listen to me and tell the others. There's going to be tracer equipment on my phone by this afternoon. If it's some kind of joke, you fellows are going to be laughing all the way to jail, I can assure you.
Mr. Bortman, I...
Shut up. First someone calling himself Peter Moulton calls, supposedly from Louisiana, and tells my wife that our boy has suddenly showed up in a picture Josh sent them of Squad D. She's still having hysterics over that when a woman purporting to be Bobby Kale's mother calls with the same insane story. Next, Oliphant. 5 minutes ago, Ryder Dotson's brother, he says. Now you.
But, Mr. Bortman, I...
My wife is upstairs sedated, and if all of this is a case of, have you got Prince Albert in a can, I swear to God.
You know it isn't a joke,
Dale whispered. His fingers felt cold and numb. Ice cream fingers.
He looked across the room at the photograph, at the blonde boy, smiling, squinting into the camera. Silence from the other end. "You know it isn't a joke. So what happened?"
"My son killed himself yesterday evening,"
Portman said evenly.
"If you didn't know it."
I didn't. I swear." Portman sighed.
"And you really are calling from long distance, aren't you?"
"From Binghamton, New York."
"Yes. You can tell the difference. Local from long distance, I mean. Long distance has a sound.
Dale realized, belatedly, that expression had finally crept into that voice. Portman was crying.
"He was depressed off and on, ever since he got back from Nam in late 1974,
Portman said.
"It always got worse in the spring. It always peaked around the 8th of April when the other boys... And your son?"
"Yes," Dale said.
"This year it just didn't peak."
There was a muffled honk, Portman using his handkerchief.
"He hung himself in the garage, Mr. Clouson."
"Christ Jesus," Dale muttered. He shut his eyes very tightly, trying to ward off the image. He got one which was arguably even worse. That smiling face, the open fatigue shirt, the twisted dog tags. "I'm sorry."
"He didn't want people to know why he wasn't with the others that day. But of course the story got out."
A long, meditative pause from Portman's end.
"Stories like that always do."
"Yes, I suppose they do."
"Joshua didn't have many friends when he was growing up, Mr. Clouson. I don't think he had any real friends until he got to Nam. He loved your son and the others."
"Now it's him comforting me." "I'm sorry for your loss," Dale said. "And sorry to have bothered you at a time like this. But you'll understand. I had to."
"Yes. Is he smiling, Mr. Clouson? The others... they said he was smiling."
Dale looked toward the picture beside the ticking clock. "He's smiling."
"Of course he is. Josh finally caught up with them."
Dale looked out the window toward the sidewalk where Billy had once ridden a bike with training wheels. He supposed he should say something, but he couldn't seem to think of a thing. His stomach hurt. His bones were cold.
"I ought to go, Mr. Clouson, in case my wife wakes up."
He paused.
"I think I'll take the phone off the hook."
"That might not be a bad idea."
"Goodbye, Mr. Clouson."
"Goodbye. Once again, my sympathies."
"And mine too."
Click. Dale crossed the room and picked up the photograph of Squad D. He looked at the smiling blonde boy, who was sitting cross-legged in front of Kimberly and Gibson, sitting casually and comfortably on the ground, as if he had never had a hemorrhoid in his life, as if he had never stood atop a stepladder in a shadowy garage and slipped a noose around his neck.
"Josh finally caught up with them."
He stood, looking fixedly at the photograph for a long time, before realizing that the depth of silence in the room had deepened. The clock had stopped.
Okay, well, there you go. Squad D, one of the lost Stephen King stories. And we can talk for a few minutes about this. I don't own these stories, and I have no legal standing to release them as podcasts, to put them on YouTube. But so far, no one has asked that I remove them or take them down, and very, very few people have seen them. It's shaky morally, but my morality says if there isn't an audio version available, and I'm not charging for it, then who cares? It's like you doing a cover of Girls Just Want to Have Fun on YouTube. You're singing Girls Just Want to Have Fun. You don't own that song. You didn't write that song. But we're okay with you putting out a cover of it. Even if your YouTube page is monetized and you get advertising, I'm okay with that. Now, if I were BMI Music or whoever owns the copyright to Girls Just Want to Have Fun, then maybe I'd have a problem. But I'm not that person. In fact, I may charge my Patreon supporters for this episode, because as far as I know, this is the last one I'm going to do, and this is the one that I wanted to do from the very, very beginning. Even before Crate, I wanted to do this one because it's lost. It's unavailable. And maybe by the time this comes out, it will no longer be so. But the other reason is, unlike Revelations of Becca Paulson, which I didn't charge for, or The Reploids, which I didn't charge for, I like this story. I'm happy to put my name on this thing. I think it's a really solid story. Now, King sent this, and I tried to do a little research, but it's nebulous. We don't really know when he sent it to Ellison, but some reports say that Ellison rejected it. And the note that King got, according to the websites that I was reading, was that Ellison just wrote, "needs work." And that was news to me, the "needs work" part, because I had always heard, not from King himself, but from interviews with King and from reports about this story, that it was accepted for the third anthology, which the first one was called Dangerous Visions, and I think the second one was called More Dangerous Visions. And the third was going to be called Again, comma, Dangerous Visions. And it was supposed to come out in 1979 or 1980, maybe 81, maybe 82, 83. And Harlan Ellison was an infamous man for many reasons. But one of the big things about Harlan Ellison was his litigiousness. He's probably best known for his science fiction stories. And after that, he's best known for being a Sue Happy bastard. And he was asked by the authors that had sold him the stories for the third Dangerous Visions, you know, when is that coming out? And he would lie. He would say, it's all in the hands of the publisher now. It's about to come out. I've seen the galleys. They're coming. We're waiting on cover art. The publisher sent it back to me. I had to do a couple of revisions, but you know, by the start of 1982, it will be out. Oh, my publisher tells me 1984, maybe March of 1984, maybe May. That's when it's coming out. By 86 or 87, some of these writers had been waiting 10 years for this anthology to come out, and people started to say, well, hey, look, I'm just going to sell it somewhere else. Or I'm a big shot writer now, and I'm putting together a short story collection, and I'm going to put my story, which didn't come out in the third Dangerous Visions anthology, in my collection. And Ellison responded with, if you do that, I will sue you. I own the rights to this story. And over the years, by this point, we're talking about the 1990s. A couple of writers actually did put their story in a collection or sell it somewhere else. And big shock, Ellison did sue them. You know, he had a contract that he owned this story until the collection came out, and then, you know, the rights would revert back to the author, but that collection hasn't come out yet. I own this story. Well, let's cut to 2018. Harlan Ellison died. And there were a lot of tributes to him about, you know, what a great writer he was. There were even some tributes about what a nice guy he was, a decent guy, a generous guy. But there were also a lot of people who had been burned by him, who thought that he was a Sue Happy bastard. And I don't know if it's fair to say that he probably made more money from his lawsuits in the last 40 years than he did from his writing. Maybe that's a pessimistic thought on my part, but I'm going to put that out there as a maybe. And I don't know that King and his story were ever involved in a lawsuit there, but I do know that this story was supposed to be in the third volume, and he, or his publisher, seems to have waited until Ellison's death before going forward with the story in any way. So it just occurred to me that there may be an official audio release in 2019, which is when you're hearing this episode. So, whoops, I may have waited too long. But oh well. Oh, that reminds me, and I should have given you a little warning at the very beginning of the episode. I am just getting over a head cold. I don't know if it's a head cold. Whatever you call it, where you're super congested, you're coughing a lot, and hacking up Bosk knows what. I really, really wanted to record this story because, well, just every once in a while, I'll get hit with an urge to do something creatively. It's not often. But I'll be like, gosh, I wish I could write right now, or gosh, I wish I could record something right now. And the one that popped into my head is this story. I wish I had the energy to do it. And because I was sick, I had slept during the day extra. And that night, I realized I was not tired. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and record the story. But you can hear in my voice that I was sick. And I don't know if it ruined the story or not. In my mind, it was like, well, the state of my voice might actually contribute to the feel of the story, because it's not a fun story, and it doesn't really need any energetic, happy voices to it. See there, I didn't cut out that particular cough, just so you'd hear. But boy, I cut out so many before then. I really should have done this sitting in quiet and had it be a podcast that dares not speak its name, because I think in the past, those Stephen King episodes have been part of that show. Oh well. Yeah, I hope the condition of my voice doesn't make it too hard to listen to. I haven't edited the story because I just recorded it last night, but I do worry about the end result. There were a couple of lines that I knew I hadn't done right. Because of my cough, I discovered that I don't have the breath control after being sick that I normally do. It's not something that I ever really considered, but doing audiobooks, you do need breath control. You need to be able to get through a sentence and breathe at an appropriate moment dramatically. And there were a couple of times when I couldn't do it last night. It sounds like I'm making excuses or apologies. If the reading is not good, then that was my fault, and I am sorry for that. But I think that the story is good. And King has, in the last 20, 30 years, grown this tendency to overwrite and to have a short story idea that he writes as a novella idea that he writes as a novel, and novel ideas that he writes as epic novels. It's not just King that does this. I probably do it as well, although I've certainly not written any epic novels. I don't believe I've said this yet, but I think that this is the revised version that was going to go into Ellison's collection. But this could be the original Needs Work version. If so, I'm curious. In what way did it need work? What was it that Ellison didn't like about it? What aspects should have been changed or expanded upon or removed? I don't know. I do have the first Dangerous Visions collection. I remember getting that at a thrift store. It's a hardcover that didn't have the dust jacket. And I looked through it and I recognized three or four of those names. And I wonder if I read it today, if I would recognize more of those names. I like to read, but I don't do it a lot. Last night, after I recorded this, I still felt like I wasn't tired. And so I grabbed a book and I made it through, let's say, 8 to 10 pages of the book before I felt myself getting tired and I closed the book and went to sleep. But I can't remember much of anything that I read in the book, which leads me to believe that maybe I was more tired than I thought, or the cold medicine was kicking in. And that happens to me a lot. I like to read before I go to sleep, but most of the time I'll make it through like a page or two pages and then I fall asleep. And unless I'm wide, wide awake, yeah, I don't have as much retention as I should. I guess the point I was making with I don't read a lot is I'm not as familiar with science fiction authors as I'd like to be. I have a few that I have read and a few of those I've enjoyed. And with fantasy authors, it's probably even smaller than that. You know, there are very few that I have read. There's one named David Gemmell. His stuff really speaks to me. And I probably have 10 or 12 of his books. And I hope to read them one day. I just finished one about a month ago, and I immediately ordered the sequel off of Amazon. And then when it arrived, I thought, oh, well, 6 months from now, maybe I will fit this one in. Yeah, if Gemmell's work has not been produced in audio, that's one that I like it well enough that I would dedicate the time to doing a reading. Yeah, I think it would be really fabulous to be a professional narrator for some of his stuff. It's really excellent work. And like early King, I feel like Gemmell underwrites. You know, 12 years have passed in between chapters. And I'll be like, no, I would have enjoyed a whole book of what happened in the next 12 years. You know, characters get mentioned and then they're dispatched or they're brought up again way later in the book. But I feel like other writers would have dedicated a ton more space to those characters so that you would remember them. But that's a double-edged sword because people like King have a tendency to create these vivid characters. You're like, oh, okay, I know who this character is. Oh, he's killed them. And in the back of my mind, when he does that, I feel like, well, why did you go to all that effort bringing this character to life if they were going to die 7 pages later? I don't know. I'm not a professional writer, and I'm not at the level of professional writers. There's probably a lesson to be learned from both. Not giving your audience all that they want to really wearing down your audience with just too much. My friend at work got me a copy of The Way of Kings by Brandon Sanderson, and the parts that I enjoyed, I really enjoyed. But that book was so overwritten that I felt like you could cut it in half. Literally take out half of the pages, and the book would be fine. I know my buddy Big was a big fan of Robert Jordan, and he said that Jordan had the tendency of doing that, of writing these giant books where very little actually happens. And then ironically, you know, Brandon Sanderson gets brought in to finish Robert Jordan's books, and people say that they got really, really good when Sanderson came on board. I've reached my destination, but I'm going to talk in silence for just a couple more minutes, okay? I like this story because it's a very Twilight Zone kind of story. You know, just something unexplainable happens. But it's poetic. It's kind of a magical thing. It's kind of... I mean, it's a dark story, of course. And it's sad. But I like it. And it's super dated because it is talking about Vietnam. Although I think it says that 1974 was 11 years ago, which would make this 1985. But there's nothing else dated about the story except for that Vietnam happened recently. Vietnam was a really, really, really important milestone in the lives of baby boomers like Stephen King. Vietnam, it divided the country in a lot of ways. It divided the young from the old, especially. Young people felt helpless. Young people felt like they were being used as tools or pawns. You know, it went hand in hand with the hippie movement. But my generation, I don't think we had anything quite like Vietnam. The other thing about Vietnam that's so interesting is that we lost. You know, it's not popular to say that we lost Vietnam. You know, we withdrew from Vietnam, I guess. But because there weren't these great victories, there was no mission accomplished, there was no D-Day, there is a frustrating, tragic aspect to Vietnam that is not there for World War I or World War II. Maybe the, you know, wars going on in Afghanistan, in Iraq, are more similar to Nam because it's an endless war. It's futile in many ways. You can't look on a map and say, okay, we won this territory and this is ours and we pushed the enemy back to this point and there were all of these decisive battles and we lost this one but we won these. That kind of war doesn't seem to lend itself to that. And so I guess I can understand a little bit, but yeah, you know, when the Gulf War broke out, there was a lot of fear among people my age that this was going to be another Vietnam, that there would be a draft, and that the young people would be sacrificed to this god of war. And I remember George Bush, January 1991, got on television, he addressed the nation, and he reassured people that it wasn't going to be like that, and there was not going to be a draft. And that and Dana Carvey's impression of Bush on Saturday Night Live are the two strongest memories I have of George H.W. Bush, as they said. He just died at the time I'm recording this, and so, you know, there was a lot of talk about whether he was a good president or a bad president. But I remembered that when they said he died, and I remembered it a lot of times over the years when people talked about Bush Sr. being ineffectual or, you know, corrupt or whatever you want to say. I mean, kids, there is corrupt and then there is corrupt. And so history has shown us that you can do a hell of a lot worse. But I guess I was talking about Vietnam. It's a sore point for my uncle because he was a young man around the time of Vietnam, and he did go into the army, and he was sent overseas but not to Vietnam. He didn't go there, but some of his friends did. And it made my uncle very, very patriotic and very intolerant of other points of view and other cultures, which I think is understandable. You do that in the military. You pound it into people's heads and you convince them who the enemy is. And the enemy has to be dehumanized or you could never fire on that enemy. I feel like I'm telling you things that you already know darn well. Sorry. So that was Squad D by Stephen King. And like I said, I don't know that I will do more. Somebody, it might have even been that same person. No, somebody sent me an email and said, why don't you record Word Processor of the Gods? And Word Processor of the Gods is a story that appeared in Playboy magazine, 1983 or so, and was collected in Skeleton Crew, the second short story collection by King. And it's one of my favorites. It's great. But I did a little search and there was an audio version released years and years ago, but it's still available. I thought I'd be able to find it on YouTube. I didn't, but I did find it online for free. And I felt like, well, this guy's reading is good. And so I don't think I'll be doing that one. But if I hadn't found it so easily online, I think I would have done that one. I guess what I'm saying is that I haven't ruled out the possibility of doing future King stories. But these two, Crate and Squad D, are the two that I set out to do when I first sat down and said I'm going to do Stephen King stories for my podcast. And I hope you enjoyed them. I did enjoy them. I like doing audio. I don't like doing the editing, but you have to. And I like podcasting. I hope you like listening to my podcasts. There are more where this one came from, and I hope you will be there when those come out too. I've been Rich Outfield, and thanks for listening. Good night.
This is Fake Sean Connery. Once again, I'd like to thank my old drinking mate, Kevin MacLeod, for the music you're listening to right now. His work can be found at incompetech.com and is released under a Creative Commons license. He can also drink a Welshman under the table. The Rish Outcast is also normally released under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which allows you to download and share it for free all the livelong day. I'm not sure about this one, though. I'll ask Kevin MacLeod about it when he comes too.